The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to introduce our guests. Born in Philadelphia, raised in Bensalem, and educated at Council Rock High School, Congressman Ro Khanna has served as the U.S. Representative for California's 17th Congressional District, better known as Silicon Valley, since 2017. He was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce during the Obama administration, and a national co-chair for Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign. Prior to joining Congress, Mr. Khanna was an economics professor at Stanford University and worked in private practice as a lawyer for technology companies. In Congress, Khanna has championed environmental causes, jobs programs, campaign finance reform, and anti-monopoly economic reforms, among other progressive issues. His latest book, Dignity in a Digital Age, presents a vision of opportunity and access for people in the parts of the U.S. whose lives have been shaped by the growth of 21st century tech, while not necessarily experiencing its economic benefits. Tonight, Rep. Khanna will be in conversation with Jonathan Tamari, the national political reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Based in Washington, D.C., he writes about policy and politics on Capitol Hill, and has helped lead the Inquirer's coverage of Pennsylvania's critical role in the 2020 presidential election. It's great to have you both with us tonight. The screen is yours.
Thanks so much, Andy. And thank you, Congressman Khanna, for joining us and coming back to Philadelphia, if only virtually. As Andy explained, you represent Silicon Valley. Got to have one of the most economically powerful districts in the country. You mentioned some of the businesses there are Apple, Google, Intel, Yahoo, but you're here partly because your roots are in our area. So just tell us a little bit about that, about, you know, your roots in Bucks County and how your family came to be here and your time growing up in this area.
Well, Jonathan, first let me thank you for moderating it and your exceptionally respected national journalism on politics. Andy, thank you for inviting me. It's a great honor to be invited to the Philadelphia Library, especially given I was born in Philadelphia in 1976, our bicentenary. My mom is actually tuned in to watch, so I'm excited. My parents, they're proud residents of Bucks County and started out in Bensalem and then moved to Northampton. They came to the area around 1975. My dad is watching too, I think. My father worked at Roman Haas, a chemical engineering company. My mom was a substitute school teacher growing up, went to Council Rock High School. My parents were immigrants and came from India, where my grandfather was part of the Indian independence movement, spent 4 years in jail in the 1940s during the Quit India movement. And he was a big inspiration for me. And then, you know, I will just say one other note. I was on Colbert, and they referenced this interview started out with something I had written. A ninth grade teacher at Holland Junior High, Mrs. Robb, and encouraged me to submit something for publication in the Bucks County Courier Times, ran with it, and the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a paragraph when I was in ninth grade. So I have very fond memories of my childhood.
Excellent. How did you end up making the journey to Silicon Valley? What is the process that led you there and had you settle in California?
Jonathan, I actually thought at one point of coming back to Philadelphia, and obviously I had a lot of friends there. I worked a summer associate at Blank Rome, which is a law firm in the city, and enjoyed it. But I then started working with Larry Lessig, who was one of the most brilliant thinkers on technology, wrote this book, Code, which is all about how the rules of our democracy and are being written by software engineers. And I felt that the most interesting work of the 21st century in law may be in Silicon Valley and thinking about how technology is shaping our society. Larry Lessig at the time was out at Stanford. So I got a job out there, really enjoyed it, and ended up settling down in California.
Your new book is called Dignity in a Digital Age. What is the genesis of this book? Why did you want to write this book, and why write it at this point in time?
I've always been struck by this extraordinary wealth generation in the Valley. I mean, probably the most wealth generation ever in one place in human history. $11 trillion is the market cap in my district. Apple, in district and surrounding areas, Apple has gone from $1 trillion to $3 trillion in 2 years during the pandemic. And you've had a 40% increase in wealth during the pandemic, while so many other parts of the country have been hurting. But the challenge is that a large part of the country has been left out, that you have the new economy not working for many Americans, jobs offshore, deindustrialization, a brain drain from communities where people are leaving. And I thought that this remote work experiment of COVID actually offered a new way of looking at technology. Then maybe it doesn't all have to be concentrated in Silicon Valley, New York, Austin, Seattle. Then now people are working from everywhere, and you can start businesses everywhere. And people in Silicon Valley have figured out not every company has to be near Sand Hill Road, and not every person has to move to the coast. So can we, with these 25 million digital jobs that are going to affect everything, manufacturing, retail, entertainment, journalism, can we put these in communities across America? And I thought this was the time to write that book.
You really drive that home at one point when you talk about a tech training program in Jefferson, Iowa, and one of the trainers there tells you if you were going that most of the classmates left Iowa after completing that training program. And he said, quote, if you were going to be successful, you had to go elsewhere, end quote. And I'll say from a Pennsylvania perspective, that was really familiar because when I was covering the 2020 presidential race and traveling to other parts of Pennsylvania, I can't tell you how many people I would meet who would say, and typically these were Trump voters who would say, you know, I grew up in this community and I got a job. I went to high school here. I got a job here. My kids, as soon as they got out of high school, they left and they're never coming back. And there was real hurt and this feeling that their community was diminishing, that their children were moving away. And you write, you know, we've overlooked the extent to which American sense of fulfillment is tied to where we live. Please expand on that. And how would you combat this, the fact that so many of these jobs are concentrated in such a few number of cities?
Well, Jonathan, I had the same experience as you did traveling to these communities. What I was struck most by is people would say there's a brain drain, that our kids are leaving. That's the same thing I heard from my parents about leaving India, that the country's people would say there's a brain drain from other countries. Now, look, I'm all for, obviously, people who want to move. My parents moved to here. I moved from Pennsylvania to California. There's nothing wrong with moving and ambition, but no one should be forced to move. People have to understand that there's a lot of advantages in staying near a community. You are close to your relatives. You're close to your brothers and sisters. You're part of the traditions of a place. You have a easier time raising your kids. And for the longest time, the message, I think, of policymakers is, well, look, just go get trained and go move to the jobs. And that was insufficiently respectful of community in this country. And so what you saw is communities having dwindling church attendance, having empty storefronts, really not having a economic future. And it wasn't just people in their 50s and 60s, people were bleak about the future for their kids. If you poll in my district, 70% of people are optimistic about America. And that's because they feel that the world is their oyster for young people. But why should that opportunity not exist across zip codes? And it's not that you have to go become a coder. That's one of the biggest myths. It's not that you have to go work for Google. If you want manufacturing jobs in the 21st century, retail jobs, if you want jobs in agriculture, a lot of them have a tech component. The jobs of building cars should not be all in Silicon Valley. The tech jobs are those. They should be in Michigan. And so the book is really saying we can bring the opportunities of the modern economy to communities to allow them to have an economic revival and not requiring people to move or have cultural displacement. And if we do that, maybe we can start to stitch this country back together.
Right. And you talk about that. You write, the central aspiration is to lessen some of the bitterness within our nation. And I think you're referring to the idea that people hear about all these, the immense wealth that you described in your district, and they don't see that in their communities. What did you see in that respect when you traveled and when you were doing the research for this book?
Jonathan, it's partly that they don't see the opportunities in their communities for wealth generation. And it's not enough. Yes, we should tax the billionaires in my district. I'm for increasing taxes on them, and then saying that as a representative there. But it's not enough to say, okay, Mark Zuckerberg, you make all the money and then we'll redistribute it to other places. People have so much pride. Philadelphia obviously was the heart of American democracy. Cleveland was the Silicon Valley of its time. People want to contribute. They want to build wealth. They want to build value. And there many of them, those communities feel that they aren't having that opportunity in a 21st century economy. And we're also not networked. You know, in the manufacturing age, when a manufacturing town did well, the railroad town did well, the coal town did well, you had kind of a web of interconnection and middle-class jobs across America. Now, when Silicon Valley does well, I'm not so sure that it really helps Youngstown, Ohio, or Jefferson, Iowa, or Columbia, South Carolina. So one of the things I'm saying is, yes, let's have economic empowerment in communities, place-based policies. But also, wouldn't it be great, as we've seen in certain cases, if you have someone from rural America working with someone on the coast, working with someone who's African-American in the South, and there's some interconnection of prosperity. We see this with Intel in Ohio, $20 billion. In my district, Intel, I was just talking to the CEO yesterday, and he said one of the things he didn't count on was this excitement in Ohio, this sense of nationalism, of pride, that there are these new jobs, there's this future, there's this economic revival. And here people in the heart of Ohio are working with people in a coastal district like mine. That's good for American democracy.
To your credit, you do present some of the counter arguments in your own book to your own points. And you note that there are a lot of experts who say that place-based planning like that just doesn't work. You can't just say, we're going to pick this city and make it a tech hub. How do you respond to that? How would you try to drive that innovation through government or through other policies?
Well, one of the most brilliant books that I cite throughout the book is that Enrico Medi's Geography of Jobs, that makes the argument that here you had the internet, it was supposed to be people working from everywhere, and actually the exact opposite has happened. And Moretti shows how you've had the concentration of jobs in certain areas and how place-based policy has not really been successful. And it's certainly worth reading. My argument is that you can't replicate Silicon Valley everywhere, and that aspiration has been mistaken. And you shouldn't try to impose Silicon Valley everywhere. That'd be a very boring world if we all worked for Google and Apple and Facebook. But what you can do is figure out what are the middle-class jobs in a digital economy going to be? Why can't the manufacturing, advanced manufacturing jobs for semiconductors be in Ohio? Why can't the jobs for making the new automobiles be in Michigan? Why can't the new jobs in energy that require technology be across Appalachia? Every region can think about what assets they have and what the digital transformation is going to do to the industries in their town, and make sure that those jobs, that their kids and people in those communities have an opportunity for it. The one statistic that people remember in this conversation that I'd like folks to remember is there are going to be 25 million digital jobs by 2025. That is more than the number of manufacturing and construction jobs in this country combined. And those jobs pay twice the median average. It is not sustainable for the economic development of our country and our democracy if all of those well-paying jobs are concentrated in a few cities. We have to figure out how to distribute them.
And now, why hasn't that happened? Why hasn't that happened, naturally to this point?
I'd argue two things. One, cultural. People just thought, oh, you have to be close to the venture capital, close to Silicon Valley. And COVID in part did a forced experiment. Folks said, well, let's work remotely. And you know what? The corporate profits went up. They went up by 40%. So they said, wow, this is actually working. We don't need all this retail in Silicon Valley. We don't need to be having this expensive housing. Actually, you can have remote work and you can have people not located in the same place. So there was a forced experiment that's led to some cultural shifts. Now, it doesn't mean everyone wants to work remote all the time. We're all sick of too many Zoom meetings. There's still a value in meeting in person, but there is a sense that not everything has to be in a few areas. But then secondly, we have neglected the policy development of place. We said, oh, just go wherever the jobs are, everything will work out. No, we have to be tangibly investing in communities, investing in land-grant colleges, investing in HBCUs, historically Black colleges, investing in smaller private colleges, and saying, we want to build the digital skills and the credentials to participate in these jobs. It doesn't even require a four-year degree. Many times it's an 18-month course. Lincoln did that with the land-grant universities to prepare us for the Industrial Revolution. We've refused to do that out of neglect or out of a lack of intentionality across this country in preparing for the digital revolution. And we also ought to involve the private sector, because a lot of times these training programs aren't effective and they don't get people jobs, and that leads to even more frustration. So there has to be a collaboration with the private sector to get these jobs in different communities.
Along those lines, you open your book in Kentucky. You talk about a gentleman named Alex Hughes, who seems his story kind of embodies a lot of both the inequities you're talking about, but also some of the promises that tech can bring to communities like his. To try to ground this in reality, tell us a little bit about Alex Hughes' story and why you chose to open with him.
I appreciate that, Jonathan. I was struck by Alex Hughes because it showed the harm of unemployment. I mean, Alex Hughes had a fight with someone and was stabbed with a knife on his face, and he still has that scar. And he said to me, being unemployed for 6 months was much worse than the pain I felt being stabbed. And that really resonated with me, that this is, he said, look, I saw marriages dissolve because of this, of unemployment. I've seen some of my friends go to drinking. This is really, it's really embarrassing to lose a job. It's a lack of pride not able to have a sense of worth. Now, Alex was very resilient, and he managed to overcome it. And he lost his job when coal started facing automation, and a lot of the coal business went under in Kentucky. And there was a systematic effort, actually supported by Hal Rogers, a Republican congressman, who called that area Silicon Holler. And, you know, it's the heart of Trump country. And he said, Roe, we got these pipes, the internet, but we got to get money coming into this area by selling stuff on the pipes outwards. And so Hughes is doing one of these jobs, and he's making good money, almost six figures. And it's not some highfalutin software coding job. He's making refrigerators. He's making laundry machines. He's just making smart refrigerators and smart laundry machines. And so it's something relatable. And what the light bulb moment for me was, here is a Republican congressman, Hal Rogers, in the heart of Appalachia, and they want access to these modern jobs and opportunities. So this is not some Silicon Valley congressman coming and saying, go to tech. This is a community saying, we want these opportunities. Why is our government failing us? Why is policy failing us? Why do our kids not have some of the same shot that kids in Rose District have?
And that kind of speaks somewhat towards this geographic inequality that happens. Your book also touches on some of the racial inequality that exists in Silicon Valley and that can be driven by these tech firms. And there was one story that really resonated with me about a young woman named Princess Sampson, who had a laptop at a very young age and became a Star Wars blogger and eventually got an internship at Amazon. And it reminded me of my own experience. I knew very young I wanted to be a journalist. When I went to high school, we had a high school newspaper and we just had computers. Like when I was a freshman, they were like, yeah, these are the computers we use to put the newspaper out. And I just thought that was how it was. And then my first summer in college, I had an internship at a small newspaper and they sent me out to do a story on a local high school that had just that year gotten computers for their newspaper. And this was like a big enough deal to them that the newspaper that they sent someone out to write about it. And it really opened my eyes to the idea that, you know, depending on where you live, it's a very different kind of experience and learning. So you talk about the importance of having laptops and that there are lots of people, particularly in communities of color, that don't have access to that. And so what is the importance that you learned about kind of having this equipment, this access for people at a young age, and how can that be addressed along with all the other issues that we're facing right now?
Well, Jonathan, my experience was similar to yours. I still remember when I was probably in sixth or seventh grade and my father brought home a Macintosh computer, and we just took that for granted. And we had in Rolling Hills or in Holland Junior High, Apple II computers. And that was part of growing up for us. And if you look at Silicon Valley, some of the tech entrepreneurs, many of them are self-made in that they didn't inherit millions of dollars, but they had healthcare and education, but they almost all had computers at a very young age. And so Princess, I started talking to her and she said, you know, there's so many people who don't have laptops in my college class at a very prestigious HBCU, and they just haven't been exposed to the technology or have a comfort with the technology or have an understanding of what is possible for them. And that is just unacceptable in a 21st century economy that we don't give our kids access to basic technology, tools that they're going to need, Jonathan, whether you become a journalist or a politician like me, or whether you actually want to go into more technological fields. But everyone needs to understand the operation of these machines. And it was an eye-opener for me into some of the inequalities that exist in terms of access to very basic technology.
How would you address that?
I think we ought to invest in making sure every family can get laptops for their kids. I mean, it's a $5 billion investment. That is a fraction of what some of the money we've spent on COVID, and it would help open up aspiration for people to understand what they can do in the digital age. I also think we need to get people basic technology literacy in school, regardless of the career they want. It's as important today as some of the other fundamental skills. You know, Robert Moses, this great civil rights leader, had this vision that you had to teach algebra to everyone, including communities that were minority communities. Today, you have to make sure people understand computers in every school. It's outrageous to me that in 47% of schools, we still don't teach computer science. I mean, I don't understand how we're doing that given the modern economy. And then on the racial gap, I appreciate you raising that because we have a 10-to-1 racial wealth gap in this country, 10-to-1, from a white family to an African-American family. Now, there are a lot of causes of that, redlining, obviously slavery and Jim Crow, the policies that excluded African-Americans from home loans. But I'll tell you something, there is no shot of overcoming that racial wealth gap if the African-American community, the Latino community is excluded from modern wealth generation, if they're not part of the IPOs, if they're not part of the jobs and technology that's driving so much of the stock market game, if they're not getting access to the venture capital. So if we have any hope of empowering communities that have been left out, we have to give them much more access to the jobs of the innovation economy.
Right. And so now that goes to the training and goes to the kind of access and education for young people. You also write about the kind of the other side of it, of the recruitment of Silicon Valley, of bringing in people of color, bringing in people who are not, you know, white male as much of the leadership of these tech companies are. And you write about how that's both driving, you know, inequality within Silicon Valley and also how it really costs them business opportunities. One of the most striking things I felt like I read was you talked to Lisa Jackson of Apple, who has a local tie, came up in New Jersey politics, was the environmental commissioner there.
I didn't know that.
She was. I covered her very briefly in Trenton before she got swept up into, I believe, the Obama administration. And she says that if you brought in a bunch of Black developers and said, write me an app, it's almost always about a social issue. And it shows how different people will come in with different thinkings on these approaches and open different avenues to business opportunities that other people might not have thought of. What is preventing Silicon Valley from having more diversity in its leadership? And again, how would you want to change that?
Well, it's a huge question because there hasn't been diversity. In fact, Lisa Jackson was very blunt with me. I said, wow, Apple's numbers are pretty good on African-American recruitment. And she said, well, don't you have to look beyond those numbers. Those are a lot of folks who are at the Apple stores, but they're not actually in the headquarters and in the software and the software engineering part of Apple. And I think there are a lot of reasons for it. One is these companies started out with networks where they hired people from the Harvards and Stanfords and people they knew, and they didn't initially make the efforts to expand. Two, there's cultural parts of the interview process that people may not know of. So one of the embarrassing things for me when I was trying to facilitate a Claflin project with a Silicon Valley company is Claflin kept sending resumes that were 4.0s and they kept getting rejected. And then we figured out that, well, those students didn't know how to do this whiteboard interview, which is a very particular thing in Silicon Valley. And so how do you actually make sure that the recruiting tests are inclusive and that people are being prepared for them? And then retention was a huge issue because people would go there and they'd be the only African-American or only Latino in a group, and they felt they weren't being taken seriously and their perspective wasn't being considered and they weren't being promoted to the highest level. So I think having a diversity in the boards is so important. And we know that diverse companies are more profitable, that they see business opportunity more. The interesting thing is you have diversity. It's not just about the Black community or the Latino community. It's about rural America. There are a lot of things about rural America that aren't represented in Silicon Valley. And the most deep point is, do you really want a few people in Silicon Valley that aren't diverse making the architecture of the modern economy, not just the modern economy, but the modern digital space? Or should there be more people who really are contributing to that?
As far as your policy proposals, I thought I was going to go through and try to check them all off and add them all up. And I realized it would take me too much time. There are so many policy proposals in this book. I'm just going to go through.
You're being polite, Jonathan. We got some good reviews, but one of my favorite critical reviews was only the people who really are policy wonks will read Kana's book and they'll skim through it. So, you know, it is full of policy.
It's full of policy. And I'll just highlight a few. You called for $100 million digital grants for future of work programs. $10,000 tax credits for tech employees hired in rural areas, a $5 billion fund that you mentioned to provide laptops, tax benefits for venture capital funds that have diverse leadership. It goes on and on. We've seen how hard it is to get even a few policies passed through Washington. So if you had to pick your two or three most important policies that you would really prioritize, what things do you think would have the most impact, would be the most important?
Well, I'd start with the Innovation and Competition Act, which is passed the Senate, which, as you know, we're hoping to pass in the House this week or next. And that would create $52 billion for semiconductor manufacturing in this country. Things like we're seeing in New Albany, Ohio. Please look that up if you're not familiar with it. They are creating 3,000 manufacturing jobs, 7,000 construction jobs. We could create those fabs across the country. It would actually help long-term deal with inflation. One of the reasons car prices are so high is we don't have enough semiconductors in this country. We're way too dependent on South Korea and Taiwan. Let's make that stuff across America. And so passing that bill also has a tech hub component to fuel new technology hubs in AI and quantum computing and clean technology across America. I'm concerned about China because they're winning right now in some areas of the clean energy race. I don't want China leading in electric vehicles. I don't want them leading in solar. I want America leading. I want that across this country. So I would invest in the new technology hubs across this country to fuel those new jobs. And then the final thing I would do is have some incentive, whether it's in the procurement process of the federal government or whether it's in the form of tax incentives, to hire in rural communities, to hire in mid-sized cities, to hire in areas that are African-American or Latino. And that's because I believe genius and talent is everywhere and that there are network effects that put some blinders on where that talent is. And you have to push people outside their comfort zone to discover that talent.
You talk, a big part of the book gets into misinformation and disinformation on the internet. And it's another one that I could relate to because as a reporter, I was always brought up that, you know, we believe in the First Amendment, absolutely. And the best idea, the best way to combat bad ideas is to shine a light on them and have them debated and debunked and have good ideas, you know, conquer over them. But we've seen that that is not always how it goes now, that misinformation can travel a lot faster and wider than true information. But it's a tough question because I'm not comfortable as a reporter with the government deciding what type of information and speech should be allowed. I'm also not totally comfortable with unaccountable tech executives deciding what kind of information and speech should be allowed. What kind of solutions would you offer to this problem that you talk about?
Well, John, that's a great framing, actually, of the issue. I mean, you're talking about the John Stuart Mill idea, the marketplace of ideas, that ultimately the truth will prevail. But I think that presupposes that you have a participation of equals and people have a say and that they're judged on the merits of the idea, not that you have a process that is tainted by amplification of certain types of information because of algorithms or because of the distortion of money. So we don't have those ideal conditions. That said, I agree with you that the government shouldn't be the arbiter of truth. In fact, there's a famous Supreme Court case, the Alvarez case, that basically says that. But the government can have some parameters on speech. Let me give you a clear example. When Facebook was aware that there were specific threats against lawmakers on January 6th with specific times and specific names, they shouldn't be allowed to sit on that information, which they are under Section 230. They have to disclose it. They have to take it off their site. And currently, even though there was an imminent threat of violence, which is illegal under Brandenburg, they had this broad immunity. So I say, at least when you're incitement of illegal conduct, you should take this down. I also think there are basic consumer protection laws. You know, newspapers can't just put out information that's going to hurt the public health. And you can't put out information that's going to cause depression and anxiety amongst teenagers. So some of those basic norms and laws need to exist in social media. But a final point I'll make, and I rely very much on this philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, who I think is one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. And he says that, you know, in your business, Jonathan, in newspapers, as he puts it, he has a beautiful line, and he says they have a commercial basis, but they're not fully commercialized. In other words, when you write stuff, you care, I'm sure, about how many clicks it gets. I care about how many clicks that my book is going to get. But that's not the only thing you care about. You have some sense of public responsibility to a democracy, which you probably imbibed since your days writing for the high school paper. That sense of any stake or responsibility to democracy is totally missing right now in social media. All it is about profit maximization, engagement, and that culture has to change.
At one point, you write about also educating people better about media literacy and internet literacy. And that really struck me because, again, going back to my reporting in 2020, I can't tell you the number of people I met who were really thoughtful about issues, who really were weighing up how they wanted to vote and would say to me, you know, it's hard to sort the real from the fake, or would tell me that they read all these good sources of news, but would give equal weight to sources that I know are not reliable, but that they did not distinguish between them. What would a program like that look like? How would that work?
Well, John, this is where in Philadelphia, virtually, I'm struck by Thomas Jefferson, who said that a democracy depends on an educated citizenry. And this has always been the case, that we needed people educated and critical thinkers. It's harder when you have a bombardment of information digitally. And a lot of times, the instinct is to think if something is written, that it has authority. But just because something is on Facebook or on Twitter doesn't mean that it's true. And you have to actually critically think about that and teach students to think about that. Now, people might say, oh, this is a fluffy idea. Actually, it's not. Finland have faced huge disinformation by the Russians in their democracy. And they created a digital literacy program. And I cite the study in the book, and they found that after this digital literacy, people were able very easily to sort what was Russian disinformation from what was not. And it worked. So we need to implement kind of a digital literacy program in our schools. And that shouldn't have a political perspective. It shouldn't be either conservative or liberal. It shouldn't be pro-Trump or anti-Trump. It should just tell people that how do you assess information and make sure you're getting a plurality of perspectives so you can come to your independent conclusion.
I want to get in a minute here to some of the questions from viewers, but at the end of the book, you say, I still believe that America is on the ascent. And I feel like that struck me because so much of what you hear right now is negative, I feel like, from people on both sides of the political spectrum. There's so much worry about the direction of the country. What gives you that optimism at a moment that I think a lot of people feel, you know, is a very dark moment?
Partly my story. I mean, obviously, I have such respect for my parents. Their story here, coming as immigrants to this country, making it to the middle class and succeeding, and having giving me the opportunity to go to a great public school, and having so many people believe in me in Bucks County that at the age of 40, this country elects me to represent an Asian American majority district that is filled with some of the most successful companies in the world. I mean, when you have a story like mine, how can't you not be hopeful about the American experiment? I recognize that there are a lot of obstacles, that there's been a lot of exclusion, and that many people have had it much harder than I've had it. And many groups, racial groups like the African-American community in particular, have had it harder than the Indian-American community. But I am struck that line about I still believe in America's ascent is borrowed from Frederick Douglass, who wrote that he believed in America's ascent back in 1869. If anyone hasn't read his speech, Composite Nation, please do after this. It's one, it might be one of the great American speeches. Here is Frederick Douglass, who was enslaved for 20 years as a free person defending the right in 1869 of Chinese immigration. And he says, I have this vision of a multiracial, multiethnic democracy, that America will be this composite nation, taking the best of all the cultures and coming up with an American distinctive culture. If Douglass could believe after having been enslaved for 20 years in America's promise, if John Lewis could believe after being beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in America's promise, certainly we who have been the beneficiaries of that sacrifice can believe in America's promise.
Let's get to some of these questions we have from the folks who've tuned in. The first one, I think, is maybe a local connection, a person named Chuck, and I apologize if I mispronounced the name, Chuck Favada, and he asks, do you remember your HMS computer teacher?
I do. I do. Mr. Favada, as I remember well, and I remember a lot of my teachers from school. I cited Mrs. Robb in ninth grade. I had a teacher I was so fond of, Mr. Longo, in 10th grade social studies. But I, of course, remember you well, and am a product of Bucks County. You know, it's now where I realize that how much of my political instincts are actually come from Bucks County. You know, we used to play, the Hoffmeyers used to be neighbors of ours, and we used to play Little League baseball and street hockey and Stratomatic and go to baseball card shows. And, you know, when I used to go up to bat, they used to say, watch the bunt, because I wasn't a great hitter. I used to be better in the field, in fact, someone had one of my favorite tweets. Someone had the team roster. We were the Expos when I was 12, and we went 2-12 or something. And he put this post up of all the players. So, you know, to me, Bucks County was the heart of sort of the best of America. And when people say, why do you believe in America? Why do you believe that we can overcome the polarization, overcome the division? I think about my childhood, and it wasn't perfect, but there was so much decency there. And somehow we have to tap into that.
Next question is from Dan Banker, and he cites a section in your book that you call progressive capitalism. And he says, isn't progressive capitalism a bit of an oxymoron? How can a hierarchically oriented system based on inequitable distribution of wealth offer true progress?
It's a great question. Here's what I mean about it. I think one of the things that sets us apart as Americans is the free market. And we don't want to have, in my view, China's model of state-controlled businesses. We want to have entrepreneurs. We want to have a Steve Jobs come up with Apple. We want to have people be able to invent things and build things and have great industrialists that helped build America. But why I say progressive is, but for the point you raise, it's led to great inequality. And there are a lot of people who don't have the chances I did. They don't have a good education. They don't have healthcare. They don't have nutrition. They don't have supportive communities. We have to give everyone that opportunity so that they really have a chance of success in a market economy. And far too many people lack that basic opportunity. And that's where I have support in the book, things like Medicare for All and free public college and a higher minimum wage.
Laura Kovacs asks, what's the role of libraries in the digital age? It's a very appropriate question here. And how will you overcome the lack of internet access in places like Philadelphia?
I think libraries have such a critical role. And the reason they have such a critical role is that they are still gathering places where you can have community. Let me say this. When Mark Zuckerberg, there's an informative interview with him where he says, you know, when I was growing up in the place he was growing up in, everyone had to play baseball and he really wanted to be a computer coder and he had to hang out with one person. And now, isn't it great in a virtual world, you can just go hang out with whoever you want and he can just hang out with coders. And that's fine, 50% of it, but he's missing the 50%, which is there's a value to community. There's a value to community in making sure that you don't have rampant racism become the norm, because that's embarrassing in a community. There's a check on that, that you're exposed to different perspectives, that you have the sense of a check on what is acceptable. And libraries, I think, provide that. They provide a place of congregation and a sense of community that's so important. I would love to see the digital library, that libraries kind of having a public forum that is separate from Facebook and Twitter, that may allow for more healthy interaction amongst people within a community funded by the state, local, or federal government, you know, sort of a PBS of the internet, but locally. And I think libraries could be a great source of that.
I want to touch on that for a moment. That suggestion struck me when I was reading the book, but I also thought, you know, I like PBS, I like C-SPAN, but I don't think I'm normal in that regard. You know, I mean, think about how it could compete with HBO or you know, TNT. So, do you think there would really be that interest in those kind of social media, that kind of alternative social media? Because there's a reason why people use Facebook and Twitter. You know, they're entertaining or they incite responses. Do you think people would really flock to a more public version?
I think that there's definitely going to be a need for Facebook and Twitter, and some of it is important, right? I mean, we focus on the bad parts, but sometimes outrage is justified and anger is justified. When George Floyd happened and you had the Black Lives Matter movement mobilizing on Facebook and Twitter and using angry language at what had happened, I think that that's fine. And some of that may not have been allowed in a sanitized public forum. And so you've seen the Me Too movement grow on these platforms. But what I think is that you also need alternatives. And if you see there are certain groups that have internet access and communication that are local neighborhood community groups. And those actually, a lot of people participate because they want to know about local events and local news and what's going on in a local community. It's why I think local newspapers are still so important. And you shouldn't just have the Philadelphia Inquirer, New York Times, and Washington Post. And so I don't think that these kind of local internet forums can displace Facebook, Twitter, but I think they can provide healthy alternatives. And one of the other points I make in the book is people partly participate in Facebook and Twitter because they want to be heard, right? They want to, they feel so disconnected by government that it's the only place they know how to express outrage or an opinion, to share or like something. What if we could create forums that actually allowed them to influence legislation, to be directly heard, to comment on legislation? It is crazy to me that congressional bills are not put online, that you can't comment on them, that you can't participate on them. We have to create forums where people feel that they're alternative places that they can exercise their duty or their desire for citizenship other than Facebook and Twitter.
Sonia Samant asks about an effort. I'm not familiar with this, but you may well be. What are your thoughts about California's statewide efforts to decrease tracking in math education? And how might that affect students' preparation for these jobs of the future?
So I am not for some of the proposals in California that say that students shouldn't be able to get algebra by eighth grade or calculus by 12th grade if they're interested in that or capable of that. I don't think having a standard lower in that makes sense, in my opinion. Now, what we need to do is invest more to overcome the disparity in math education. And that's what Robert Moses was talking about in saying that everyone needs to have algebra and we need to do a better job of training and education of math in communities that have been left out. But I'm not for lowering certain standards. And that's not going to help us be competitive in the 21st century, nor is it doing justice to those young people.
A question here from Roger Lehman, who says it has been suggested that social media should be federally regulated so that certain bad actors can't disseminate misinformation, like vaccine skepticism, for example. Do you think a bill like that could even pass? Is it feasible in a technical sense? And what misgivings might you have about that, if any?
I'm for well-crafted regulation, but it does have to account for speech. I mean, so you don't want FTC or FCC making all the decisions about speech. If you're a Democrat, think if it was Donald Trump appointing that FTC and making decisions of what speech would be allowed. And if you're a Republican, think if it's Joe Biden making those decisions. So it's dangerous to give too much power to these regulatory agencies. That said, there are things we can do to improve the situation without giving the agencies that much power. These sites shouldn't be able to collect so much of your data. They use this data and then they target the most vulnerable to grow and QAnon and to manipulate people online. So having restrictions on data would help. These sites should have basic public health and consumer safety standards. It's one thing to say express all viewpoints. It's another thing if sites are actively saying don't get vaccinated when we know that that's leading to more deaths in America. And so I think having public health standards is appropriate. Having consumer product standards is appropriate. And making sure that they're not inciting violence. So we need more regulation than currently is there, but that doesn't have to lead to censoring particular viewpoints.
Okay. Dan Banker, again, he mentions your appearance on Colbert, which clearly the second most prestigious book event you've done so far.
Of course, not as detailed. You've clearly of all the book events I've done, you've read the book the most carefully.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that that comes through. me and Colbert both Northwestern alums, but you know he was in theater, I was in journalism, so
You may have a second act.
I don't think I'm as entertaining as Mr. Colbert. He mentions on that show, you talked about privacy. But he says that, you know, big tech makes a lot of money in using our information and selling it and monetizing that. So how is privacy attainable in the current setup?
It's not unless Congress acts. I mean, big tech doesn't have any incentive to change the way they're doing things without the law. And that's why the Congress, the first principle of the Internet Bill of Rights that I propose in Chapter 6 is, you should have to affirmatively consent to having your data gathered. What does that mean? Right now, when you go on sites, most people just click yes, 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 yes. And they're basically clicking, accepting the default, which is that their data is going to be taken. What I'm saying is, no, that's not good enough. That the default should be your data is not taken. And if you are okay with your data being taken, you have to type in something, hey, I'm okay with my data being used for these purposes. And that would really restrict these companies' ability to exploit the data. Now, there are legitimate uses. You may say it's fine for the company to share my credit card information with a third party verifier so I can buy things online. You may say it's fine for them to know my geography so that I see ads for pizza places that are in Philadelphia, not in California. But you should have the ability to set the parameters of what data they're going to use.
Okay, and I think this is going to be our last question. It's from your old teacher again, Mr. Favada, and he asks, do you think regulatory agencies reflect the prejudices of their time?
That's a great question. I think they do reflect the prejudices of the time. And so obviously there is bias to any regulation, but I would say more than that, they are also inhibited in terms of the technological understanding. And so they're unable often to regulate these tech companies because they don't understand some of the tech companies' techniques. They don't understand that tech companies can manipulate the design of a website to get people to click or manipulate the colors. And that's why I think you need more technologists at these agencies to go toe-to-toe with the technology companies and coming up with the regulations. And I also think ultimately this is why we have a democracy in elections, so that the regulators are reflecting ultimately the president, who is elected by everyone. And if the times change or the views change, then the regulators should change.
All right. Well, those are all the questions that we have. So Congressman Khanna, I want to thank you for doing this event in Philadelphia, for inviting me to participate in this event, and for spending all this time with us. Thank you very much.
Well, Jonathan, I'm really honored. I really appreciate your taking so much time out of your busy job to read the book as carefully. I appreciate everyone tuning in, and really a great conversation. And it was particularly meaningful to me to be doing it back where I grew up and was raised.
Thank you all. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.